Well, I want to give a little bit of an introduction to Kokyo's Samantabhadra and his 10 vows. Kokyo will be starting a class on this on Saturday, on Sunday night, and it'll go 4 weeks. And the class will be on Samantabhadra's 10 vows, for which he is noted. As you guys know, we studied the Lotus Sutra in the last practice period, and Samantabhadra makes an appearance in the last chapter of the Lotus Sutra, so I thought I'd say a little bit about that. I spoke about this in the closing sesshin. I'm going to look at one piece a little more closely in chapter 28 of the Lotus Sutra. And in the Lotus Sutra, Samantabhadra only makes one vow. He vows to go wherever the Lotus Sutra is being preached and to support the Lotus Sutra. He even says that if the teacher forgets a few of the lines, he'll coach him. He'll coach him or her. So this is Samantabhadra's vow in the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra says that the Bodhisattva way is the unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment vehicle. And that enlightenment is the experience of emptiness or suchness. And in the last 5 or 6 chapters of the Lotus Sutra, he gives examples of lives of bodhisattvas, how they are actually practicing with this wisdom. And the last chapter is devoted to Samantabhadra. Excuse me. At that time, the Bodhisattva, universal sage, which is the translation of Samantabhadra, with his divine powers, his dignity, virtue, and fame, and accompanied by unlimited, innumerable, incalculable numbers of great bodhisattvas, came from the east. All of the lands through which he passed shook. Treasured lotus flowers rained down, and countless hundreds of thousands of billions of kinds of music was playing. In addition, he was surrounded by a great assembly of uncountable numbers of various gods, dragons, satyrs, centaurs, asuras, griffins, chimeras, pythons, people, non-people, and others, all displaying dignity, virtue, and their own divine powers. Arriving at Holy Eagle Peak in this world, that's usually translated Vulture Peak, isn't it? Arriving at Holy Vulture Peak in this world, he prostrated himself before Shakyamuni Buddha, circled around him to the right 7 times, and said to the Buddha, "World-honored one, in the land of Buddha, jeweled king of superior dignity and virtue, when I was there, from a distance, I heard the Lotus Sutra being taught in this world. I have come with this multitude of countless innumerable hundreds of thousands of billions of bodhisattvas to hear it now and receive it. Please, world-honored one, teach the Lotus Sutra to us and tell us, good sons and daughters, how will we be able to obtain the Lotus Sutra after your extinction?" So, this obtaining the Lotus Sutra is, I think his question is, how will we continue to practice and learn and be encouraged in our experience of emptiness and suchness, to encourage our experience of this unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment without our founding teacher, and without the support of all of the Sangha that we've been practicing with for the last 40 years. What's to become of this practice? What's to become in future generations? I think that's his question. How can we experience our Buddha nature? This, in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha starts predicting Buddhahood for one after the other of his followers, and finally he's teaching that everyone has this nature to be Buddha. Their Buddha nature, it's in them like water flowing downhill. It's not something that has to be developed. It's something that just we sometimes pay attention to. We're sometimes aware of it. Sometimes we can kickstart it a little in the early mornings when we've got a little bit of resistance to coming here, or when we're getting home from work, or when our families are around at dinner time on Wednesday nights, and we have to sort of think, do I really have enough energy to spend the next hour or so at the Zen Center? So sometimes we put some effort into our spiritual lives, And when we're fully paying attention then, when we get to the Zendo and we're sitting upright, then our intrinsic Buddha nature is right there, blossoming. I think sometimes it's said that it's the Buddha nature, our Buddha nature itself, that is the source of that dialogue of do I have enough energy for this? Do I have enough energy to go to the Zendo this morning or this evening? It takes our effort out of it, but it's our Buddha nature that is we're having the dialogue with. I want to give Kokyo a little compliment. I thought this was a very good in his article that he wrote for Buddha Dharma magazine. It was a very nice, concise definition of our Buddha nature. Our own Buddha nature, the open, compassionate, boundless nature of mind. So it is that which is in us, our open, compassionate, boundless nature of mind, that starts having this dialogue with us about practice, about our experience with the Buddha way, with the Buddha mind and body. So the Buddha goes on to answer Samantabhadra, who is saying, how can we practice? Where do we get the support for our practice once you're gone? The Buddha replied to Samantabhadra, if any good sons and daughters meet four conditions, after my extinction they will obtain this Lotus Sutra. The first is to be protected and kept in mind by the Buddhas. That's a funny one. Protected and kept in mind. You know, initially it looks like there's a Buddha out there that's kind of watching our behavior. And say, "Well, I'm going to watch this one. I'm going to keep that one in mind." But I think this means more like once again engaging with our Buddha nature. This article that Kokyo wrote was about Kanodoko, the mystical communion between Buddhas and sentient beings. When we get the idea, to start sitting, to start looking at our life, to start, most of us come here, I think, when we have a question like Samantabhadra. What's the meaning of life? What is my purpose? Where do I look for answers to the great matter, or maybe we come here because of suffering. We're aware of our own suffering, and uh, we uh, we want to look outward, or Buddhism says we look inward, but I think when we come here we think there's got to be something I can learn or experience to help me with this suffering. Just as we start asking those questions, and we have a little opening. We're saying to ourselves, inside this skin bag, is what Buddhism calls this body, inside this very confined space, I can't figure it out. I need to open. I need to get some perspective. So we start dropping all of those maneuvers that we've been doing to figure out the great matter or to resolve our suffering. We stop going over and over our habits, and we are open to other things. And that's when we start paying attention to our Buddha nature, this compassionate, boundless mind that has always been there. I think that sounds good to me, about, rather than thinking of the Buddhas as protecting and keeping me in mind. I think I'm turning towards my open, compassionate, boundless mind for the experience of the great matter. What does it say in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi? Inquiry and response come up together. Who am I? What is the nature of true reality? When I start opening up to the great matter, and my small self, my old habitual habits, I'm willing to drop so that they can get out of the way. I think that's the first condition that Buddha said when Buddhas are protecting and, what is it, protecting and keeping in mind by the Buddhas. I think this is that mystical communion between the small self and the big self. The second condition, or the second the condition that people need to meet to be able to keep alive the teachings of Buddha, is they need to plant roots of virtue. Planting roots of virtue. On NPR today, there was a story about what some coastal cities are doing about the possibility of sea levels rising in our period here of global warming. And one idea for the San Francisco Bay Area is to reclaim many thousands of acres of marshland around the bay that over the decades of development have been lost, largely to provide landfill for all the population that's grown up around the bay. But apparently restoring these marshlands will bring back the native marsh plants, which not only help fix the soil more firmly, but the above ground plants reduce kind of wave action as well. It's a huge amount of land, and if they can get a good percentage of it, they feel that it will accommodate any rise in sea level, whatever. No one can predict how much it will rise, but these roots are about in the marshlands are about stability, and the roots of virtue mentioned here are also about stability of the practice. Samantabhadra in the Lotus Sutra says that studying and reciting and teaching and copying the Lotus Sutra is planting virtuous roots, which is the experience of our Buddha nature, the expression of our Buddha nature, the manifesting our Buddha nature. I want to let's see what if any receive and embrace, read and recite, and remember the Lotus Sutra correctly, understand its meaning, practice it as taught, they should know that they are doing the work of Samantabhadra. They have planted good roots deeply under innumerable countless Buddhas, and their heads will be touched by the hands of the Buddhas. It's a great image, you know, maybe our feet are underground, underneath where the Buddhas walk, and maybe just you know, when the Buddhas are going down to inspect this newly replanted marshlands, they'll bend down and there's a Zen student down there. Thank you for supporting me, for keeping this practice, for supporting this practice for all these many, many kalpas. They have planted good roots deeply under innumerable countless Buddhas, and their heads will be touched by the hands of the Tathagatas. When Edie was ordained, I couldn't help you know, you stand at one point. I'm standing above her, and she's got one little hair left on her head, and I chant three times. You know, will you let me? Will you let me cut it? And rather than kind of lurching over, you know, with the razor, I just rested my hand on top of her head. Edie has planted virtuous roots over her decades here, as a lot of people have. You know, supporting the temple, supporting the practice. We've got a Sangha day, a work day coming up in I think it's the Saturday after this one, where we can support the temple by cleaning up and doing yard work and doing a few repairs. We can support the practice by Volunteering for roles like the doan, the bell ringer, or carrying incense. There's opportunities after you've been here a while to be on committees or the board. So these two are planting virtuous roots and maintaining the practice eon after eon. We've been here since 1972, and we're the second or third generation that have been here, all thanks to Zen students who have been planting roots here at Santa Cruz Zen Center and keeping this practice stable. Dogen says that in the fascicle, is it called Everyday Life of the Buddha or Everyday Activities of the Buddha, such as planting roots, that some of us who sit here in the morning say that that our sitting practice in the morning perfumes the rest of our day. You know, maybe in those first few minutes when we leave here, we've still got Zazen mind, which Dogen says is unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. That that mind of no self, that mind that's boundless, excuse me. And as we start down the road, or as we get home, maybe we're not exactly with Zazen mind, but our experience of the mind and body of Buddha is perfuming the rest of the day. And maybe with some practice, with some zeal, we can maintain that Buddha mind throughout the day. And Dogen says that any activity done with Buddha's mind is Buddha's activity of awakening with all beings, of liberating all beings with their suffering. This fascicle, Everyday Activity of the Buddha, talks about pretty ordinary events, but done with Buddha mind and body, all of our events of the day are for the service of liberating all beings, of awakening with all beings. And our practice just kind of gives us, well, it gives us practice. It gives us confidence. It gives us ease to maintain that body and mind. I think it's why we come back. We experience that mind of boundlessness and compassion, even if it is just for those 40 minutes. And we know that this is our true body and mind, and we wanna visit it regularly. Suzuki Roshi said, recommended daily practice. He said, visit that mind regularly. Get used to that mind. I think when we first come here, it's a familiar. We want to go to where this mind is familiar. It feels like It feels like home. It feels like our true home. And when we get to the point that we're a little out of sorts, whether it's our own suffering or we're really inspired to work with the great matter, to experience the great matter, I think we see that it's none other than our true home, this dropping body and mind in our meditation. Becoming confident is what our Zazen provides us, confident in trusting our experience in Zazen, of becoming familiar with the voice of our Buddha nature. Here's another news item. Catherine watched the news a lot late at night. I don't know when she slept, but her favorite news commentary show was on at 11 at night, and she was here every morning. So there was a time during the day that she could take a nap. But last night I just happened across this show on PBS about a high-ranking evangelical minister. Did anyone see that? The show is called Independent Lens, but it was a hour and a half documentary on Reverend Schenck, who identifies himself as pretty conservative. As a youthful minister, he was quite active in the anti-abortion movement. And now he's ahead of a lot of evangelical organizations. And he has looked around at the violence in the United States, gun violence, and he's starting to think that maybe the tenets of Christianity and gun ownership are not compatible. And he's starting to talk about that with all of these. I think most of his career at this point is administration of big organizations. So he goes to a lot of meetings, and he's starting to talk about that. And he's not sure how to do it, because the language, you know, isn't in his community. And he wonders if he has the confidence to bring this out, to really go in that direction. And he's wondering if his comrades, who he said over and over that he really loves, he spent his entire adult life with most of the other people that he's working with now, he wonders if they're going to trust him. And he's using his practice of prayer and to try to develop the language and the confidence and the trust. It showed him talking in this small meeting with very bright, energetic people. There were just about six people, and they were a little surprised, and two of them said that they had guns in their drawers right there. I mean, their desk drawers, not their underwear. And this Reverend Schenck had no idea that he'd been going to work every day, and there were guns within you know, 6 feet of him. So he's developing the confidence to start talking about this, and to feel that you know, these are that what he's planting are, you know, roots to stabilize his community, rather than, I mean, he feels that that gun ownership and Christianity are not compatible, that gun ownership upsets the ground that Christians walk on. So he's hoping to plant new roots. So it was a very moving show. But he's looking at his practice. He's, you know, maybe in the same way that we look to the Lotus Sutra in Dogen, he's really trying to find these references in the Bible that he can, just to continue the metaphor, keep cultivating, such that he can stabilize what he feels is an unstable part of the Christian ground. The third condition to be able to express Buddha nature eons after the death of Buddha: join those also on the path headed for awakening. That sounds simple enough. Just come to Santa Cruz Zen Center. Start hanging out with other people, other like-minded people, and that makes very good sense. You know, being, you know, reinforced and supported, you know, day after day with people who are, you know, looking at the same life issues and bringing practice into our lives. That makes very good sense. Buddha was saying, you know, come join us. Come join us. I was you know, profoundly reminded of the great power of Sangha. Exactly 1 year ago was when I was in the hospital, and that was really an opportunity for me to be discouraged and angry and separating the world into before and after the hospital. Before I could really concretize all of those thoughts, most of you wonderful people were at my side, you know, showing me the wholeness of my true life. And it truly was a treasure. The part of the triple treasure is the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It truly was an example of Dogen's fascicle, One Bright Pearl. We were just all one kind of luminescent pearl, supporting each other, and I felt that support. So the Sangha, people on the path, people headed for awakening, awakened, people experiencing their awakened nature, is maybe the way Dogen would say it. We were all awake together. And so there was no outside. There was just boundlessness. Catherine gave one of my Dharma names is Mugai, no outside. And I dutifully pronounced my name, Hidden Dragon, no outside for quite a long time. And it, I think when the term Mugai is used in, you know, in language, when someone is actually speaking Japanese, it does mean boundless and infinite. You know, there's no place to step out. And that's what, our experience in the Sangha, can teach us, that, that we are one bright pearl, that there is only awakened mind, and helped me remember that mind that includes everything with boundless compassion. The fourth condition that a good son or daughter wishing to practice and maintain practice and settle into their experience of Buddha nature. The fourth one is to maintain the vow to liberate all beings and save them from suffering. Samantabhadra is known as the Bodhisattva of great activity. The supreme activity is awakening with everyone and liberating them from suffering. I think we liberate others from suffering in a conventional way. There is so much suffering and so many opportunities to help others in this world, and in the ultimate realm, our practice, being confident in our practice, viewing the world with our Buddha eyes, viewing the world with our experience of emptiness, allow, as the Genjo Koan says, when we drop body and mind, 10,000 things are liberated. 10,000 things don't have to hit the barrier of our judgments. I want to give merit to Nettie, who started off this conversation in our Monday morning study of Nagarjuna. Just this Monday, we had this discussion of our, you know, we trust our experience that, you know, whenever I see Sally, I've had the experience of Sally for many years, and I've made up a story about Sally, you know, that fits me, but based on the experience we've had over the years, and I trust that. And I trust that when I see Sally downtown, I'm going to recognize her. She's going to look just like she does right now. I trust that experience. What happens if, as I mentioned earlier, what if I were meeting Sally with the mind of unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. That mind of no separation, of no difference, of infinite compassion. How can I be confident, you know, in that, you know, body and mind of Buddha, which I carry with me all the time? Could I possibly carry it around with me throughout the day, just as I spoke before, and interact with people with that experience, rather than the experience that I'm pretty comfortable with already? Nothing wrong with that experience, but there's another aspect of meeting and interacting that I could also employ, that I'm settling into, that I'm planting roots for, that I could employ. And this is too is saving all beings, and planting the roots of using our zazen to get comfortable with that mind, and employing that mind and engaging that mind as we engage with the rest of the world, is what we practice here in our sitting. So these are the four conditions that a person might have if they want to keep this practice going in their lives generations after the death of our founding teacher. Meeting the Buddha and being met by Buddha. Planting roots for the stability of our practice, these virtuous roots, whether it's studying, whether it's supporting the temple, whether it's supporting the Sangha. Hanging out with Sangha members. Practicing at Zen Center. And then saving all beings. This was Buddha's response to Samantabhadra. How do we do this practice? How can we be open for such a huge practice? And Buddha gave us these four things to consider. Why don't I wrap up here? And if there's time for a couple of questions. I've tried to use as much of the language as the Lotus Sutra that I could, and show that it really is about the practice that we're doing here 2 centuries later, and the lives that we're leading here 2 centuries later. So any thoughts on these four qualities, these four conditions? Edie.
Where do you think intention fits in?
Fits in.
Fits into those four.
Well, I think it's a little like a cat chasing its tail, in the sense that at some point something arises in us, that's probably our Buddha nature, but maybe conditions in our lives trigger an attention to this Buddha nature, and we start asking those questions about the big matter, the great matter, and we start practice, and we start feeling that, oh, for these 40 minutes, this is my true home. And so then what arises is not only the facility to pay attention to our Buddha nature more, but our intention to keep on with this practice. It has become intention and zeal and energy is one of the six bodhisattva practices for enlightenment. And so once we kind of get that taste of our or that experience of our true home, I think we want to keep coming back to it. And it starts becoming higher on our list of priorities for things that we start organizing our life around it. You know, how can I check in with this Buddha nature? And so I think it continues to grow as we practice. Does that make sense in your life too? I think, you know, another definition of Buddha nature I've heard is that experience of accord with all things. And I think we can have a conscious feeling of discord and then start paying attention to our Buddha nature to generate more accord in our conventional lives. And then I think Buddha nature, you know, as something that's innate, something that's not conceptual, I think we find that it's the experience of accord or the experience of being in our true home or the experience of our life in the one bright pearl is kind of the non-conceptual idea of it. So that too can have some intention. You know, I want to face in the direction of accord in my life. I need to start fixing a few things. I need to make this a priority. And then what we find is that accord, that harmony, is innate in us already, and it's our true home. Thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.